health crisis. The state's existing yellow flag law imposes additional steps, including requiring families to report a person in crisis to police. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 54 degrees and overcast. In New York City, 59 degrees and partly cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, April 12, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on our brothers and sisters in Baltimore to discuss the human side of the Key Bridge collapse and how it directly affected Baltimore's Latino community. Late last month, the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, Maryland collapsed when a large cargo ship collided with it in the early morning of March 26, killing six construction workers. In the aftermath of the tragedy, serious questions in the Baltimore area are left to be answered in terms of responsibility, safety regulations, rebuilding, the city's economy, and means of production. But the intent of today's show is to focus on the human side of this tragedy by putting a much-deserved spotlight on Baltimore's Latino community. Because while the aforementioned questions of the bridge should not be understated, what has been lost in corporate media following the bridge collapse is that it is Baltimore's immigrant community that has paid the price for dangerous construction work, lax safety regulations, fear of authorities, and various other issues that set this tragic chain of events in motion. And yet it is the same migrant community in Baltimore that will be at the front lines of rebuilding the bridge. And so the least we could do today is tell the story of the community that keeps Baltimore running. And so with us on the show today is Maximilian Alvarez, who's the editor-in-chief of the Real News Network in Baltimore, Maryland. It's an honor. Welcome to the show, Max Alvarez.
Thank you so much for having me, brother. It's an honor to be here.
Absolutely. And also joining us on the show today is Clara Longo de Freitas. She's a community reporter for the Baltimore Banner. Welcome to the show, Clara Longo de Freitas.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Absolutely. So let me just preface this by saying that I myself lived in Baltimore for a while attending Coppin State University over on the west side of Baltimore. And I have to be honest with you guys, Max, I initially thought about reaching out to you and others in Baltimore the week that the bridge collapsed. But I hesitated because I had a hunch that more details were going to come out as the story developed. And sure enough, Claire and the good people at the Baltimore Banner have done a great job in bringing more details to light on the story. One of the first stories that developed in the initial hours following the collapse were reports of an unnamed person being rescued from the water but refusing medical care shortly after the collapse. So this detail in the story came and went in mainstream media, but for people that follow the plight of immigrants, was this something that deserved further attention? I'm not just saying this to you, Max, as somebody who hosts a show on the radio, but also having worked in the medical world for 15 years, I have seen that fear and hesitation of migrants with regards to seeking out help, whether it be medical, whether it be police related or otherwise.
Right. I've seen it too. And I think that all of us who have seen it could see in that one detail from the early morning reporting the day of the Key Bridge collapse, something very different from what, frankly, a lot of our colleagues in the media who apparently don't know a lot of immigrants, they don't even just have to be Latino immigrants. You know, we saw a very different thing, right? Because when I heard that early morning around 1:30, when the Dolly crashed into the load-bearing pylon on the Francis Scott Key Bridge, and that 8 construction workers working for the non-union contractor Bronner Builders, who were filling potholes on the bridge in the middle of the night and who were on their lunch break when the bridge itself collapsed, but who themselves did not get a warning about the impending bridge collapse. They did not receive the Mayday call from the Dolly. That was a detail that I confirmed when I spoke with Jesus Campos, who also works for Bronner Builders and worked with the men who died on that bridge when I interviewed him by the bridge on the day of the collapse. So on the way there, there's a Royal Farms gas station right next to one of the entrances of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. That's where my colleagues Kayla Rivara and Jocelyn Dombrowski and I were headed as we were, you know, like trying to learn as much as we could about the situation. And I also want to say just credit to Clara, but also like so many of the other incredible journalists in this city for really showing what collaboration looks like and how we can better serve our community when we don't see each other as competitors. Because while we were driving to that site, our former colleague, Jessel Knorr, another great journalist in the city, was at home on a Zoom call telling other journalists, including us, like, this is where you should go. This is what I'm seeing online. You know, Claire and I were like lifting each other up, asking like, hey, have you talked to this person? Could you put me in touch with that person? Like, we were all doing our best to try to get the information the community needed. And in that firestorm on the morning of the bridge collapse, I noticed this detail. I believe I first read it in the Baltimore Sun's reporting that when the bridge collapsed and 8 men fell into the Patapsco River, 6 of whom we know died, 2 of whom were recovered from the water that morning alive. The details were very sparse, but what they said was that one of those men was taken to emergency medical care and one refused emergency care. And I saw white anchors, news anchors in Baltimore repeating this fact and saying like, oh, I guess that guy, the second guy must have just been fine and walked home. And again, like that may have been the case. They may not have known any better. But like, if you know undocumented people, if you know construction workers, if you yourself, as I have worked with a lot of folks in those kinds of situations, people who are uninsured, people who have, you know, like all these reasons to be wary of, you know, the police, to be wary of hospitals, so on and so forth, your mind immediately went to, oh, that person was sin papeles, or they were uninsured, or both, right? And in fact, when I sat down with Latino community organizers that you mentioned for that bilingual podcast that I recorded at the Real News Network, these were incredible folks in the community: Ricardo Ortiz, Susana Barrios, Carlos Crespo, Lucia Islas, along with the co-owners of El Taquito Mexicano in Fells Point. You know, they confirmed, they were like, yeah, like what we know is that that person did not have insurance. And what, just think about that. Anyone out there listening, just think about what that says about our country, to imagine the situation you would have to be in to go through the most traumatic experience in your life, being on a bridge when it collapses and you fall into the water, your colleagues, your coworkers, your friends are dying all around you. You're in the cold waters of the Patapsco River in the middle of the night, and you are so worried about the cost of the medical bills that you refuse a trip to the hospital. Like, if that is not an indictment on the U.S. healthcare system, I don't know what is.
Claire, I want to get your response, and if you saw the same red flags as myself and Max did as the story developed in the initial hours.
Yeah, I think immediately when I saw that there were construction workers and they were the ones who were among the missing, my initial thought immediately went, I'm sure that these are immigrants. I'm sure that these are Latino men. I had the same thought as Max when we heard about the one person who refused medical attention. It seems now that this is someone who might have been a state inspector and that they ran out of the bridge as it was collapsing. It's very unclear, but I had the exact same thought as Max, right? When we hear someone refusing medical attention, we think, is this someone who couldn't afford to pay the bills? Is this someone who is scared that being taken to the hospital would mean somehow, you know, being taken to the authorities and that might cause them to be deported in some way? I think what Max said is true, that these are the questions that journalists like us have when white anchors and white reporters don't, because it's just not on their reality, right? So that's also speaks to the power of having journalists who are part of the communities that we cover. Because we will think about this, we will look into things that it won't come immediately onto other people's minds, because that's just not their reality or the reality of the people they love.
Yeah. And even if this person wasn't physically traumatized, I can imagine that they were psychologically traumatized with tons of steel and concrete falling above and below them, and possibly seeing their coworkers and friends dying as all of this is unfolding. You know, those sort of things happen so fast, you know, you will know what to think as it happens. So last year, I was a producer for Latino Rebels Radio, and I had the pleasure of speaking with Rose Godinez, who's an attorney for the Nebraska chapter of the ACLU. This was around the time that we were discussing migrant child labor in the meatpacking industry in that part of the country. In our discussion on migrant child exploitation, she described the meatpacking industry as, quote, rife with retaliation. So to my understanding, that may not necessarily be the case with the company that contracted the workers that perished in the collapse, but it is the case with Maersk, the company that owns the cargo ship that crashed into the bridge. Because according to The Lever, the company was recently sanctioned by regulators for blocking its employees from directly reporting safety concerns to the U.S. Coast Guard. So even though both you and Max were able to talk with people in Baltimore's Latino community, did you still confront anyone that was scared to talk to both the press and authorities for fear of retaliation? Max, I know that you mentioned Jesus Campos, and I did see him in certain places being interviewed. And even as he's open to talk, you can hear sort of the tremor and the fear and the trauma in his voice as to what just happened with regards to not only his coworkers, but I would imagine his friends as well.
You know, poor Jesus was clearly very shaken by everything. And, you know, I think that there were a lot of emotions running through him, and I felt some of them myself. And again, the fact that I was able to speak to him in Spanish there when so few people on the ground there were able to do that, you know, I think just like you can hear, like you said, the tremors in his voice, you can pick up on the tones and understand the depth of pain in the words that he's articulating. And yeah, I mean, like, you know, I run into this all the time. I mean, as someone who interviews working people in different industries, different jobs, union, non-union, across the country, across the world, like I do that for a living here at the Real News Network. And it is fundamentally part of what I do to take, you know, as many precautions as I can to try to protect people's jobs, to try to protect their immigration status, their lives, their livelihoods, because so many people in this country are, in fact, at risk when it comes to things like that. I mean, like in, you know, the majority of states around the country, like you can be fired just because your boss doesn't like the look of your face that morning. That's what right to work actually means, right? And to say nothing of, again, just the tremendous amount of unseen workers who keep our economy running, who provide so much of the essential labor that we all depend on, even if we don't value it, whether it's filling our potholes at night, whether it's delivering, you know, like our food orders through gig apps, whether it's, yeah, like, you know, children, like younger than my foster daughter, cleaning bone saws and meatpacking plants, or picking tomatoes under slave conditions for our Wendy's cheeseburgers in Florida, or, you know, children in, like, working in Hyundai parts suppliers in Alabama. Like, I mean, like, cleaning office buildings, domestic workers cleaning houses, right? How many of those people do you actually know? if you do know people in that position, then again, you know the kind of calculations that a working person in that situation has to go through. They could be undocumented, or they could be a returning citizen coming back from prison, right? I mean, they could be someone, you know, like who has had a criminal record and is trying to, you know, get their lives right, but they have to like wade through this horrific tangle of red tape and all these opportunities for them to fall back into the criminal justice system, for them to lose their jobs, lose their homes in a society that criminalizes poverty and homelessness. Like, we live in a really intense meat grinder that so many working people are working their days away in just to try to provide for themselves and their families. But yeah, like so many of the immigrant workers that I talk to, folks who are working under the floorboards of our society, these are the kind of situations they're in. I'll just give one example that came from the podcast that I recorded with the Latino justice organizers here in Baltimore. One thing that they said is, again, while immigrants, especially Latino immigrants, but not exclusively, are being vilified in the media, are being vilified by Donald Trump, who's out there saying that we're poisoning the blood of this country, that we're sucking all of the tax revenue away from like citizens. Like, if you listen to these workers, the people in this community that I spoke to and that Clara's speaking to, that you speak to, you'll hear a very different story. You will hear my foster daughter, Norma Martinez, you know, who herself, you know, has been undocumented from Honduras, has a lot of friends in high school who have to drop out of school and work construction because they can't pay for college. They're not going to get government assistance. Just like Carlos Crespo told me that it was our community, the immigrant community, especially the undocumented community, that was like suffering the most intense effects of COVID because they did not have access to government stimulus checks. They did not have the government support that we had, as inadequate as it was. I mean, it was still life-saving. And for people who didn't have that, they were going into work without proper PPE, without sick pay, without these protections. A lot of people died. A lot of people got sick, have long COVID. Like, this is just one of many, many examples of how immigrant workers and people who are working in the shadows of our economy are hyper exploited. And yet they are the ones who are being targeted as the vilified outgroup in this country.
Clara, I want to get your response to the issue of fear within the community with regards to reaching out to authorities or the press, because the wife of Julio Cervantes, who survived the bridge collapse, even though she spoke to the media, she did not give her name at all as well.
A lot of family members have refrained from talking to the media right now. I think in part is because this is a tragedy that was broadcasted to the entire world that has been, you know, playing on televisions all across the world over and over again. So I think the families are in distraught. And one family still is waiting for three bodies. So I think in some ways it's out of grief that they haven't talked to the press. But they are also scared, right? This is something that I encounter a lot when I talk to people from East Baltimore, especially Latino communities, because they might be undocumented or they might see the media as complacent in some ways with the government, and they don't want to speak out. They don't want to talk to authorities. They don't want to get in trouble. And that's something that always happened. And that's when community organizers kind of come into play. I think community organizers in a lot of way act as spokespeople in some ways, but also just as someone who can comfort them and explain the ways, you know, the media is not here to prey on you or to take you to the authorities or anything like that. Like, I'm happy to provide anonymity to people, especially if they're undocumented or if they're going through immigration proceeding. But there is that fear, right? Especially when in their home countries in Latin America, a lot of times media is controlled by the government. So there's just a lot of disinformation in terms of that. But yeah, I think mainly people have been scared because they don't know how the information is going to be used. They don't want people to know where they live. But I think in a lot of ways, they're just still grieving, and they're still kind of coming into terms with the death of the loved ones in a very abrupt, very tragical way.
And you made a good point by mentioning that the grieving process is still going because the bodies of these construction workers have still not been recovered yet. And so this further prolongs that grieving period that you just mentioned, which sort of prolongs the whole tragic chain of events here that we're discussing here. And it's interesting with the case of one worker, Miguel Luna, who's from El Salvador, because as I was looking up information in the initial days when this story came out, I actually found more information about him from La Prensa Gráfica in El Salvador than in CNN or in MSNBC here in the U.S., which was quite astounding considering all the resources that corporate media has. So, Clara, I want to turn our attention to the workers that actually died in this bridge collapse. Miguel Luna, Alejandro Hernandez Fuentes, Dorian Castillo Cabrera, Minor Suazo Sandoval, Jose Minor Lopez, and Carlos Hernandez. So you've written extensively with regards to some of these individuals in the Baltimore Banner during your recent articles. What else can you tell us in the context of this discussion that we're having right now about a few of these individuals that deserve our attention as we speak here?
Yeah, of course. So the last story that I did was about Jose Minor Lopez. I spoke to his brother last week. One thing that kind of stood out to me was that Jose Minor Lopez, he liked to drive around and like blast music. He would have his daughter in the back seat and he would like sing it to her. For whatever reason, he really liked to live stream it while doing it. And you can like hear his voice kind of being louder than the singers and just being a very, you know, happy man. Someone even said it in the comments, like, you're very happy, brother-in-law. Like, in Spanish, it's a de feliz cuñado. And I talked to his brother and that's basically asking like, so the way that your brother's portrayed himself in social media, is that how he is? And he was like, yeah, he was a very friendly guy. He was always, you know, offering to help. It seems that this was, you know, a very humble man. You know, he came from Guatemala. He came here because he wanted a better life, pretty much. Like he had some stability back in Guatemala. Like he and his brother worked with horses. They got some money with that. No one in his family was in immediate danger, but there was that ongoing sense of hopelessness, right? That ongoing sense of terror, their ongoing sense of there's no future here. So that's why he ended up migrating to Baltimore. He was probably around 19 when he made the trip, and he would send money back to help his family, his mother, father, and his sister. And then his brother came here as well when he was 18. They worked together often in construction. I believe it was his first week or second week doing the bridge work when the bridge collapsed. Yeah, and all of the men had similar stories in that regard. Like you were all men who came to the US because they wanted a better life. In a lot of ways, they're not living like exuberant lives here, right? But they are able to send money back to their home countries so that the family can have a better chance there. Like the other guy that I was able to talk to the family was Maynor Suazo Sandoval. I talked to his cousin, and because Maynor worked and sent $600 to $800 each month, the family was able to focus on education. So all of Maynor's nephews and nieces were able to go to school because they didn't have to leave school to go to work or to provide for the family. Like Maynor was doing that. So the family could drive and do it as well. He was here, you know, just trying his luck. I spoke to the friend of the youngest worker who died. His name is Dorlian Cabrera. Dorlian was from Guatemala. And, you know, growing up, he was very popular. He was an athletic guy. He liked to play soccer. He liked to ride his motorcycle around. And then as he grew older, he began to focus on work. And, you know, this was a very young guy. So he was just, you know, in the beginning of his life, he didn't have a family here in terms of, you know, he didn't have a spouse or children. It seemed that he followed with some of his friends who came before him and he was living with them. So, yeah, he was also described as, you know, just a happy, hardworking guy who treated people well and treated people with respect. The other workers, they were all related in some capacity. They were either cousins or son-in-laws. They were from El Salvador and Mexico, I believe. We don't know too much about them, mainly because the family was very clear. Like the family of Miguel Luna was very clear that they did not want the media to reach out to them. They didn't want people to know about them yet. And we just decided to respect their wishes. So there's not much we know about them. All we know about Miguel Luna is that he was from California in El Salvador. He had three children, and he was a member of CASA, the immigration advocacy group. And he called Maryland home for almost half of his life at this point.
Thank you for giving us that information, because as I stressed at the beginning of the show, I wanted to put the human side to this story front and center so people can understand why the community has reacted the way it has and why more help is needed for this community as the grieving process continues here. During the course of this conversation, you notice that we've discussed both labor exploitation and migrant exploitation along the way here. Another component here that you just brought up in explaining the human side of all of these individuals is the issue of poverty and how poverty forces people to migrate to the U.S. to work in these exact dangerous jobs that we're talking here. Max, I want to bring up the issue of East Palestine, because you've spoken about this extensively already, but nonetheless, it's still quite surreal the way I look at it to go to East Palestine, work on that story, and then come back to Baltimore and see what ended up happening here. So go ahead.
Yeah, man. It was literally 24 hours after I got back from East Palestine at 1:30 in the morning on that Monday, and then at 1:30 in the morning on the following Tuesday, the bridge collapsed and my head was spinning. But I just, like, before jumping into that, just also want to, echo what you said and underscore how invaluable the work that Clara is doing for the banner to lift up the humanity of these brothers who perished and their families, their lives beyond just the horrible circumstances of their death, right? I mean, in so many ways, these immigrant workers have only become momentarily visible to the rest of the country in their deaths, right? What would it look like if we were more visible to each other, if we recognized each other on this human level while we were all alive? Like, imagine the kind of world that we could have if we saw each other that way. And so it's a real credit to Clara for focusing on that when so few journalists in the city will. But to kind of pick up on that question about East Palestine, I guess for folks listening, if they don't immediately see the connection, the point is that for the Real News Network, for my podcast, Working People, for a number of years, you know, I've been, along with my colleague Mel Buer here at the Real News, we've been interviewing railroad workers because, again, that labor is like one of our key beats, and we talk to workers themselves. We have these long, deep, human-to-human conversations with working people, not just about their jobs, but about their lives, their dreams, their struggles, and everything in between. And so we were doing that with railroad workers amidst the high-stakes contract fight that we all remember from 2 years ago that culminated in President Joe Biden and both parties in Congress working together to squash a potential railroad strike and force railroad workers on the freight rail system to accept a contract that the majority of those workers did not want. And those workers on the railroads were warning me constantly that some catastrophe was going to happen if the greedy, cost-cutting, corner-cutting, staff-cutting, automating, Wall Street, you know, like minded takeover of the railroads was not reined in, right? Because the Wall Street vampires and corporate overlords who have, like, you know, just taken over this vital part of our supply chain, they've run it like, you know, they've run workers into the ground. They're destroying the supply chain and the long-term safety of our communities and our neighbors for the sake of short-term profits. And they are incredibly profitable. The railroads are more profitable than they've ever been. You can't find a better business to invest in right now because of the profits they're raking in, because of the shareholder dividends that they're paying out. So anyway, that's all to say is that that led me to cover the railroad strike or the potential railroad strike and the crisis on the railroads. And then when East Palestine happened, 2 months like after Biden and Congress forced that contract down railroad workers' throats, you know, we have this horrific derailment of a Norfolk Southern bomb train in East Palestine, Ohio. This is a small, you know, like Appalachian town. This is your quote unquote Trump country where you got white working class folks. It's a town of about 4,500 in eastern Ohio. That's about an hour away from Pittsburgh. So on one cold Friday night, their world was turned entirely upside down when this Norfolk Southern train that was like, you know, incredibly long, incredibly heavy, carrying incredible amounts of toxic chemicals that very few people actually knew what was on that train at the time, let alone very few first responders knew what was on it when they were responding to the derailment call. So Lord knows the kind of exposure that they had to those toxic chemicals when they were just trying to respond to an emergency. But anyway, the point being is that that train derailed on February 3rd. 3 days later, the disastrous, avoidable, unnecessary, catastrophic decision was made to vent and burn 5 cars worth of toxic vinyl chloride because, according to Norfolk Southern, they were worried that those cars were going to explode. There was going to be shrapnel going for miles around. And they gave local first responders essentially 13 minutes to make a decision of whether or not to go through with that plan to empty those cars and set them on fire, which is what they did, which is why we all saw that huge, massive black death plume rising above the town a year ago. And that death plume was spewing toxins, dioxin, like for miles and miles around. And people have been exposed to that. Children have been exposed to that. Old people, young people. These are bioaccumulative. Like, they are building up in people's bodies. And I've been interviewing people in this community all year because what's happening to them is so horrifying. And the fact that we're not helping them is even more horrifying. And so that is what eventually led me to finally getting there in person to report on their struggle and shoot some documentary footage while we were there. We were also there because there was a gathering of labor unions, environmental groups, delegations of community members in other sacrifice zones, or people living near other rail lines, like this coalition of forgotten people coming together there in East Palestine where this horrible thing happened to say, like, we need to band together to stop this because they're messing with the workers. They're driving them into the ground. And the same companies are driving our communities into the ground and poisoning them with derailments like this. So anyway, I was filming there in East Palestine 2 weeks ago. I got home to Baltimore late at night. A day later, the bridge collapses. And the reason that I think it's so significant is twofold. One, I thought it was really incredible, really beautiful, and really powerful that the first text messages I was getting on the day of the bridge collapse were from residents of East Palestine, people who felt a solidarity with, again, a majority black town in a democratic state that people in East Palestine are constantly told by Fox News and everyone in the media that we are their enemies, that the immigrant workers on that bridge are their enemies. And yet, these folks who have gone through this horrific catastrophe were seeing in Baltimore echoes of what they themselves had gone through. And I want to be very clear, as I have on every interview, the Baltimore bridge collapse is not the Norfolk Southern train derailment. These are not the same thing. But a lot of the same questions arise out of the fact that both of them happened, right? Because just like when the Norfolk Southern train derailed a year ago and people were saying, we don't know what caused the accident. All we know is that was a faulty bearing. Whereas if you talk to workers, their immediate response would be, why was a train that long carrying that many hazardous chemicals allowed to be on the track with a faulty bearing in the first place? And that's where you get into the issue of all the staff cuts, the people who are supposed to check those cars, the people who are supposed to have time to do their job properly. But instead, you got one guy doing the job of five, and he's going to get his head chewed off if he reports any issues by management. That's why, like, we saw so many residences in Baltimore was like, yeah, we know there was a catastrophic electrical failure from this like massive shipping vessel a few minutes, 30 minutes after it left port. But again, we're investigating where that electrical failure came from. But the question that should be on everyone's minds is, why was a ship this massive going underneath a thoroughfare this important in this densely populated of an area allowed to leave port when it had these technical issues that should have been caught, right? I mean, there's a whole regulatory regime that has been eroded over decades, and the sort of profit-driven drive and thirst for profits is what is leading railroad cars to get longer and heavier while the crews on them get smaller, just like international shipping vessels are getting bigger with more cargo, with fewer crew members on them. Like, this is part of a larger process that has been going for 40 plus years. And I think that, like, we are going to continue to see more disasters like this, from the BP oil spill to Boeing planes falling apart in the sky. I mean, like, this is what deregulation and the lack of a robust, safety-minded, not profit-minded regulatory regime actually looks like.
We're going to take a break right here, but I just want to say right now that both Max and Claire have done more to respect the memory of the construction workers by giving us this detail and this nuance into the whole issue at hand in just 30 minutes and what most of corporate media has done in the last few weeks. So we're speaking with Max Alvarez. He's the editor-in-chief for the Real News Network in Baltimore, Maryland, and Clara Longo de Freitas, who's a community reporter for the Baltimore Banner. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. And you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone, you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, we're focusing today on Baltimore's Latino community following the Key Bridge collapse with Max Alvarez, who's the editor-in-chief for the Real News Network in Baltimore, Maryland, and Clara Longo de Freitas, who's the community reporter for the Baltimore Banner. So another issue here that is important to understand Baltimore's Latino community is that according to the U.S. Census, the Latino community in Baltimore nearly doubled between 2010 and 2020 to at least 45,000 plus. Considering that a few of the victims' families have set up GoFundMe pages, have local officials in Baltimore been able to keep up with the needs of the city's growing Latino community even prior to the bridge collapse? Even Bronner Builders, the company that contracted the workers, has a GoFundMe page. Claire, I want to start with you here because I'm not necessarily knocking GoFundMe. It has its purposes in other, you know, situations. But for it to be used here seems kind of wrong and perverse, considering the help that this community needs right now.
I think that the Latino group is something that the city has been grasping with for the past 10 years at this point. I think that one way that they have been grasping is through talking more about language access. I know that last year there was a hearing where basically community organizers were asking for more Spanish speakers in city government. I don't have the numbers right now, but compared to the numbers of non-English speakers in the city and compared to the numbers of how many of these non-English speakers are Spanish speakers, the amount of people in city government who speak Spanish is pretty low. So I know that there was a push on City Hall to hire more Spanish speakers, and the push was largely approved from what I remember. People said, yes, we do need more Spanish speakers. But I think actually doing that is a whole other can of worms, right? I know that the city public schools had been trying to hire more teachers from countries in Latin America and just trying to attract more immigrants. But I think that the city just faces a retention issue in general, and just attracting people to move to Baltimore is a whole other ordeal. But I do think that having an office of immigrant affairs has been helpful, and especially an office that has consistently worked with the community. I think that in a lot of ways, the organizers and the community organizations that support immigrant communities has functioned almost as like a forefront of government. Like, they have their own network, they have their own supporters. It shouldn't be like that, right? The city government should be able to help these people without having all of these community organizers doing much of the work. And this is something that Catalina Lima Rodriguez, the director, said when they were having a hearing about making the office permanent, the mayor's immigrant affairs permanent. In the best case scenario, MIMA, the immigration affairs office, wouldn't exist, right? We wouldn't need an office like this, but we do need it. So this is a long-winded answer to say, I think that there are a lot of efforts to try to better help immigrant families. I think a lot of these efforts still end up relying on community organizers and the work from them.
You know what? That's actually a really good answer, because it kind of reminds me here in Washington that we're heading towards the 33rd anniversary of the uprising in Mount Pleasant, which brought the attention of the Latino community here in Washington that government officials over here otherwise ignored. Now, in the years following, there was more resources put into Latino affairs, whether it be more Spanish-speaking police officers, things like that. Will the same thing happen in Baltimore following the Key Bridge collapse? Only time will tell. But I wanted to bring that parallel in order for people in Washington to understand the development of Baltimore's Latino community along the way. Max, you had something to say?
I just like also wanted to underline, you know, the point that Clara made, which I think is, I really don't want to be lost on folks, is that like we have a retention crisis, you know, like in general when it comes to like, say, teachers in Baltimore. And like my answer to your question would be like, is the city adequately responding to the rise in the Latino population? No, because the city isn't even adequately responding to its own native population. That's been the case in Baltimore for many years. I mean, this city's been losing population for decades. It's been over-policing its under-resourced communities and throwing people in jail, brutalizing them. I mean, like the systemic racism, redlining was invented here, for Pete's sake. I mean, like, Baltimore has so much promise and so much potential, yet it has been squashed under the thumb of racism, of neoliberal policy, of, you know, like, again, serving the interests of the wealthy, the rich developers who are sucking, getting all these tax cuts to build up high rises on the waterfront while communities in West Baltimore slowly decay in the air, right? And yet, that is the kind of situation that we have in a place like Baltimore, but it exists in so many different forms across this country. And when you have so many different forgotten populations within that who feel as beaten down, brutalized, forgotten, and beleaguered as, you know, like folks in East Palestine do, folks, you know, like in undocumented worker communities do, folks in West Baltimore do. It's like everyone feels forgotten and everyone feels a little resentful towards the rest of the country because we're constantly being told that we are the enemies, that, you know, again, people in East Palestine aren't getting help because all the immigrants are taking all the government money, when like what's actually happening. The immigrants that we've been talking about here are filling potholes at night and trying to provide for their families just like everybody else, right? We are not the enemy. So we have this kind of class dimension in this like larger onslaught of the 40 plus year march of corporate domination and yada, yada, yada. Like if you see class as part of that, then you can also understand how and why, you know, communities like East Palestine, where it is predominantly white, you know, like working and lower middle class, are feeling finally a kind of solidarity with communities like Baltimore, just like we're feeling solidarity with poisoned Black communities in Cancer Alley in Louisiana and poisoned Navajo communities in Navajo Nation that have been poisoned by uranium mines for 50, 60 years and are now suffering the harshest effects of the water climate-related crisis, right? I mean, like, the examples are kind of endless, but the point being is that in terms of like understanding like the larger crisis here, the schools and the retention crisis is a perfect case in point. Because again, as someone with a Spanish-speaking daughter in Baltimore schools, I can tell you firsthand those schools are not prepared for Spanish speakers. They barely have any teachers who can speak Spanish, let alone materials that are in Spanish. And so they got to rely on people for that. But they're also struggling with retaining teachers in general, you know, like, and getting people to teach in these underfunded, under-resourced schools. So it's a perfect encapsulation of the larger problem that we have in America. But I think the more that we are all feeling that squeeze, the more that we are all understanding that, in fact, it's us, the proverbial 99%, the working people of the world, who are bearing the cost of all this corporate greed, all this deregulation, all this market-minded politics, you know, eventually we're going to wake up and realize that we got to start banding together to be the change that we're waiting for and fight for our communities if these companies and a lot of our elected officials are not going to do it.
100%, I totally agree. And so this is why I'm going to create a link on our Twitter account to both Max Alvarez's interview with the Latino community that he did through the Real News Network. And we're also going to create a link to some of the articles that Clara Longo de Freitas wrote for the Baltimore Banner as well. Because we have about 6 minutes left. So before we go, I just want to point out that this week, Maryland Governor Wes Moore signed the PORC Act into law, providing scholarships for children of construction workers who died on the Key Bridge. Generally speaking, it's a step in the right direction in helping the families who lost loved ones in this tragedy. And it's certainly a far cry from the racist attacks on Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott, the paranoid rhetoric over migrants prior to the tragedy, the conspiracy theories of DEI and CRT, and various other nonsense. One thing is clear, the Key Bridge collapse demolished the lies about immigration and applied to migrant workers should have been the main story from the very beginning, in my opinion. Because if construction workers losing their lives filling potholes over a dangerous bridge isn't enough to recognize the importance of the sweat equity that migrant labor brings to the U.S., what will? And so, as I stressed before at the beginning of the show, I want to bring the human side to this story. So in the last few days, there was a memorial service at Highland Town in Southeast Baltimore. There was also a memorial at the Bridges West End on Fort Armistead Road, as well as Fort Smallwood Road. Have either of you, in the last few minutes that we have left, have any of you been to the memorials? And if so, what else do you take from the community's response to this tragedy?
I went to a vigil in the very first week when the bridge collapsed, where some community organizers were present. But I think in general, the community organizers were just hurting. They weren't, you know, related personally to the workers. But I don't know, they're still part of the community. And I think that in some way, it's just something that they see in different scales, but they see it very often. I mean, early February, early March, there was a fire on Lumber Street. Two kids died. One young man died. And I think that they're just kind of tired. Not tired in the sense that they won't do this work, but I think it's the type of work that is very time consuming, very emotionally exhaustive to just kind of continue to see immigrants being failed by different circumstances. I know that Susana Barrios was really emotional during the vigil. She was really upset. And at that point, I think she was feeling a little hopeless. I know that other community organizers have this, you know, kind of been autopilot, just kind of like, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to reach out to this person, then that person, and you're going to coordinate this. That's just like, they're autopilot. They're just trying to help as much as they can. But I think there is like a sense of, yet again, something else is happening in the community that they need to kind of like, you know, put on their boots and keep going.
I'm basically right where you are. You know, I'll go out and visit these new memorials, but I've been mainly talking to, yeah, folks in the community who, as Clara said, I mean, that was the sense that I got talking to these incredible community organizers and just, yeah, they're regular working people themselves. Most of the work they do, as Clara mentioned, is volunteer based. I mean, you know, these are folks who have their own children, their own families, their own jobs, and yet they are spending, you know, so much time devoting, like, you know, every effort they have to improving their community and helping their community members. And so I really want to shout out, if folks in Baltimore are looking to support, you know, organizations that are doing good work and want to lift them up, I would highly recommend reaching out to the Latino Racial Justice Circle, the Centro de Apoyo para la Superación del Inmigrante, or CAPSI, the Comité Latino de Baltimore. We mentioned CASA. I mean, like, there are so many organizations out there that are doing good work, but they definitely need help. So please support them. But yeah, that was the tenor of the conversation I had with those incredible folks, was as long as God gives us strength, we're going to keep fighting for our community, but we are tired. We are tired of doing this work while being vilified in this country. We are tired of fighting, you know, to be seen as human beings first so that we can then, you know, like, get the kind of just basic treatment and sympathy and recognition that any human being deserves, especially in a moment of tragedy like this. We are tired of people not seeing us just as their fellow workers and neighbors and who are trying to make a life for ourselves and who have so much more in common with you than, you know, like, you're led to believe. We're tired of constantly having to prove that to people while we are, you know, like these men, working our butts off, like their families that are working their butts off. Whether you're working on a bridge or keeping a household going, all of that is vital labor that families cannot go without. And yet it is all unseen. It's not seen as part of just like the basic human context of our lives, whether we were born in this country or not. You know, so much of what we want out of this life, so much of the dignity that we are trying to get for ourselves and our families, you know, like, that's just like everything you listening to this are going through right now. So what the folks in Baltimore told me is that, yes, these efforts are going to go on because the hole that was left in these families, that's never going to be filled. They're going to be living with the effects of not only losing those breadwinners, but also losing those loved ones, right? That's going to hit them and be impacting them for the rest of their lives. So the organizers are committing to being there for those families for the long haul. And the same goes again for anyone in this country who's experiencing that kind of tragedy. Like, again, I think about the connections between the workers who died and their families here in Baltimore related to the Key Bridge collapse and the folks in East Palestine, Ohio, who are all putting out GoFundMes because their medical bills are piling up. Their ailments are piling up. They don't know how they're going to afford their medicines or, you know, their food, and they're putting out GoFundMes. And in every case, you realize that, like, charity for people who are going through this is only going to get us so far. Like, we need systemic change because we don't have enough to give to provide what these communities, these families need. It has to come from a larger change in the way that we understand our society and the way that we are trying to kind of take care of people and support working people so that they can have the lives that they and their families dream of, instead of constantly fighting off these attacks and constantly scrapping to make ends meet in a hostile country.
Max, Clara, as we've had this conversation today, the news cycle in corporate media has already gone on to other stories, but I wanted this show to be a statement of intent against the mechanisms of corporate media when it comes to moving on from story to story. And this is why we're going to create links to the work that both the Real News Network and the Baltimore Banner have done, because it's quite clear that we've only just scratched the surface with regards to the challenges facing the Latino community in Baltimore in the coming weeks, months, and years ahead. So with that said, we've been speaking with Max Alvarez. He's the editor-in-chief of the Real News Network in Baltimore, Maryland. Thank you very much. It's been an honor. Thank you for being on the show with us, Max Alvarez.
Thank you, brother. It was a real honor to be with you.
Absolutely. And we've also been speaking with Clara Longo de Freitas, who's a community reporter for the Baltimore Banner. Thank you very much. It's been an honor, Clara Longo de Freitas.
Thank you so much. This was great. It was great talking to you.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone, you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
The best in live music entertainment is coming this spring to Bethesda Theater. Let's welcome music royalty, The Whisperers, performing all their classic songs for two big shows on Friday, April 26th at 8:30 p.m. and again on Saturday, April 27th at 8 p.m. Also coming is Trouble Funk, featuring go-go legend Big Tony, celebrating his birthday by performing all their go-go classics on Friday, May 3rd at 9 p.m. And on Mother's Day, it's Howard Hewitt performing his own popular songs and those by Shalimar for two shows on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. The Whisperers on April 26th and 27th, Trouble Funk featuring Big Tony on May 3rd, and Howard Hewitt on Mother's Day, May 12th. Get more information on all shows at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Millions of people in India began voting today in a six-week election to choose members of the lower house of parliament. Almost a billion people, or more than 10% of the world's population, are eligible to vote in the election. The election is seen in part as a referendum on Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who has pursued a political project of Hindu nationalism and is seeking a rare third term in office. The election will be held in stages, running until June 1st. Votes will be counted on June 4th. If Modi wins, he will become only the second modern Indian leader to win a third term in office. Polling suggests Modi will succeed. The United States vetoed a widely backed UN Security Council resolution yesterday to admit Palestine as a full UN member state. The U.S. was alone in voting against the resolution. 12 of the 15 council members voted in favor, while two, Britain and Switzerland, abstained. U.S. Ambassador Robert Wood defended the veto by insisting that a negotiated two-state solution agreed upon by both Israel and Palestine remains the only legitimate path to the long-elusive goal of Palestinian statehood. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas condemned the U.S. veto in a statement as, quote, unfair, unethical, and unjustified. Israel's U.N. ambassador claimed that the overwhelming support for Palestine in the vote was in fact an obstacle to peace, and questioned whether, quote, the Palestinians are peace-loving. Palestine's UN ambassador Riyad Mansour countered, saying Israel would seek to block statehood at every turn and ensure that, quote, Palestinian people are exiled away from their homeland or remain under its occupation forever.
We love life, to live in freedom and dignity in our national homeland. We will not disappear. Either you deal with us with fairness and give us our rights or give us our rights. Thank you very much.
Israeli drones appeared to strike a major Iranian airbase early this morning in a much-anticipated retaliatory step in the conflict between the two countries. A years-long proxy war became a direct conflict this month after Israel struck an Iranian diplomatic compound in Syria and Iran responded by firing hundreds of drones and missiles at Israel. This morning's Israeli retaliation appeared to target an airbase in the central Iranian city of Isfahan, where Iran stores its fleet of old American fighter jets purchased before the 1979 revolution. At a Group of Seven meeting, Italy's foreign minister said the United States had received last-minute notice of the attack from Israel, an assertion U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken did not dispute. Blinken said the U.S. was, quote, not involved in any offensive operations. The U.S. and other countries assisted Israel in intercepting most of the Iranian counterattack last weekend. G7 ministers warned of new sanctions against Iran today, following its counterattack against Israel last weekend, and urged both countries to avoid escalation. Just yesterday, the U.S. and U.K. imposed new sanctions on Iran, targeting people and organizations associated with Iranian drone production. The U.S.